Welcome to the Infrastructure Show. I'm your host, Professor Joseph Schoffer of Northwestern University. The Infrastructure Show is designed to present to listeners the reality of America's infrastructure, its condition, why it is the way it is, and what can be done about it. We gratefully acknowledge contributions to sustain the Infrastructure Show from Dr. Robert Peskin, Dr. Raymond Ellis, and Andrea and Ron DeFeo. Occasionally, we like to focus a podcast on a unique historic infrastructure project. The Erie Canal, constructed in New York between 1817 and 1825, certainly fits that description. As we celebrate its bicentennial, it's appropriate to review the achievements of its builders in construction, project management, and finance, and to remind ourselves of the potential of the right infrastructure project at the right time to produce vast economic and social benefits. To learn about the history of the Erie Canal, we've invited Brad Utter to join us. Brad is the historian and curator with the New York State Museum, and he's also the author of the 2020 book, Enterprising Waters, The History and the Art of New York's Erie Canal. Brad, I'm really happy to talk with you today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
So give you an easy question. Give us a brief description of the Erie Canal. Many of us haven't been there, and many of us live very far away from it.
Okay. Well, the Erie Canal is basically a there are three generations of it. You've got the original canal, which you mentioned, opened in 1825. Then there's an enlarged canal, which opened, which they declared complete in 1862. And then there's the barge canal, which is what we see today. And that was declared complete in 1918. And the barge canal that you see today is not only a man-made channel. It utilizes rivers and lakes along its path, and that goes from Waterford, New York to Tonawanda, New York. And Waterford is just north of Albany. It follows a similar path to the original canal, but there are differences, you know, and there's slight differences with each generation of the canal. But the main focus, especially of the original canal, is that it opened a path from New York City via the Hudson River to Lake Erie and the Great Lakes.
So how let's talk about the original canal. How long was that?
360 miles. The Erie itself.
And did it use any of the existing rivers, or was it completely separate?
It was completely separate in that the channel that was traveled was not in any of the rivers, but they utilized the rivers for water sources. And early on, there were a couple of river crossings, and they discovered that wouldn't last. swift currents swept boats over dams, and so they introduced aqueducts, which were part of the original plan, but smaller aqueducts were built where they thought maybe they could cross the river but could not. And I can only think of maybe one or two places where they actually still crossed the river itself into the late 19th century.
And when you say cross the river, they're at a different level. That is, the canal is above the river.
In most spots, yes. The canal is above the river, but other cases, it's you know, the river may be higher, further out, or the canal is running parallel to the river.
Okay. And the original canal had many locks, as I understand it.
Correct. Yeah, the number that's given is 83 actual lift locks, and that varies. There wasn't a true map made at the time, right? There wasn't a real map of the actual canal done by engineers until the 1830s. So there are some debates over whether you call a certain thing a lock or not, but 83 is the given. That's kind of the accepted number. of locks.
And the locks were manually operated, as I understand it. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes, the chambers, and it wasn't new technology per se. It was, you know, older technology, and the locks, you know, served as like a boat elevator to change elevation, and they had lock tenders at each lock that were responsible for operating the gates letting boats in and out, collecting tolls where necessary.
Who built this lock, this canal? Who gets responsibility, gets the credit for it?
So the obviously something of this magnitude is you know, a lot of people are involved. And if you are looking to who designed it, you know, there's the political side, who made it happen. Then there's the engineers who are really surveyors, or at least that was their background, and they learned kind of on the job. Benjamin Wright, who's considered today as the father of American civil engineering, who I probably don't have to explain that to your audience, but he was the only one with much experience at all, and he had worked on some earlier canal efforts and worked with William Weston, who was an English engineer, actually professionally trained engineer. And so he became the chief engineer of the project. And then others who were also surveyors and many other jobs on the side kind of learned on the job and learned by reading books and experiencing it as they go. And then the laborers at first, so this is your first large-scale use of contract construction, and certainly in New York State, if not America. And the idea was that the legislature wanted to help the farmers and the people along the route get the work. So they bid out small sections for contracts, and you know, so the laborers at first were usually American-born or American citizens, if you will, living along the route or nearby, who would bid and do, you know, a quarter mile or so or a mile of digging. And as the project carried on, they started to recruit laborers from Ireland and other areas to come and help. So there's the misnomer that the Irish built the canal, but really the Irish immigrants didn't come until later, and they were largely responsible for the labor on the enlarged canal, which was taking place during the potato famine and the large influx of Irish immigrants.
So it wasn't a matter of going to Ireland and recruiting labor. It was a matter of taking advantage of Irish immigrants who wanted to come to the United States for other reasons.
That is for the enlargement, but they actually did, and they did both. Believe it or not, they during the enlargement, they had sent out calls for laborers in Ireland, specifically looking for people with experience digging canals, and that's another long story because it never escapes the politics and financing, and when they first started the enlargement, they were looking at deficit spending, and then another party, so the Whigs were setting that up, and the Democratic Republicans take over, and they don't want deficit spending. So that call for laborers in Ireland actually got put on hold because they didn't want a deficit spend. And so the enlargement took a long time to build, and it, you know, there's a major debate that, you know, we even see today of big government versus little government. So it depends on the era. If you talk about the barge canal, a lot of that was built with Italian laborers, Italian immigrants. And they were recruited from New York City and brought up along the route. And many of them stayed in the communities along the route. And you've got pockets of Italian influence that that, you know, added to the culture of the local community.
So what was the driving force? What was the motivation for building this canal?
There are many, and the big picture is that the Appalachian Mountain Chain basically limited any large-scale commerce between the East Coast and what would become the Midwest and further. So you have people who have ventured over the Appalachians, and they're trading with Canadians or down the Mississippi to Spanish and French in either direction, and also English, but they're not trading with the East, and it's considered part of, you know, it's part of the United States. And Washington saw this early and said, hey, you know, talked about the bond of union where commerce is really the tie. So if you're living in central Ohio and you can trade with Montreal much easier than you can trade with New York City, then you're going to do that. Even in Western New York, one of the studies they did with Dwight Clinton and others in 1810, they asked the locals where they traded. And a lot of them traded with Canada, or they traded down the Susquehanna Valley to Baltimore. And so New York State was losing this trade. But the
link, the trade link, was water, right? Through the Great Lakes and through the river system in the Midwest. That was what was missing in the connection to New York, I think. Is that right?
Yes, and that's the connection missing to the East Coast, where most of the population is. So, like Washington was saying, if we're not bound by commerce, then we're going to lose the allegiance of the settlers going west of the Appalachian Mountain Chain. And he was correct, and that was one of the main pushes. And if you look at the map, a topographical map, New York is a logical spot. It's the only real break in the mountain chains that isn't significant over a large, you know, you're not going over a large mountain to get from the Hudson River to the Great Lakes. And so that was one of the pushes, and you have all these resources. You have limited ability for people that went out there. There was limited ability to trade. So especially in Western New York, you get a lot of subsistence farming where they're not really in a position to make a lot of money. They're just trying to survive. And you've got population growth and people needing land, where to go. So the canal is not only opening up for settlement, but opening up the resources that we had, that the United States had in the central United States.
This sounds like a story of the Erie Canal being the nexus between the political economy and the integration of the nation and the natural geography, that there was an opportunity here to do something that people really wanted to do.
They did. When the politicians would talk about it, it looked great on paper. But, you know, Jefferson called it a little short of madness to think that they could do it. He thought it was, you know, years ahead of its time. And a lot of that was because they didn't think you could raise the money to do it. And because they didn't have the engineers to do it. New York State really took it by themselves and said, no, we're going to make it happen.
So it was certainly an advantage to New York, but my own reading in the history says that there was a discussion at the federal level to put money into it, and Madison, as the president, stepped in at the last minute and vetoed the bill that might have done that.
That's correct. And there are, at the time, and Jefferson had promoted infrastructure work before as well. And then when it came down to it, it looked like the money could go to New York for a canal. And then Madison, when they finally came to a vote, vetoed it. They said it's on constitutional grounds, but really a lot of people at the time felt that the Virginians didn't want New York to get the canal over Virginia. And because they were, you know, they knew, they could see what the potential would be for a canal and what the outcome would be. And Virginia enjoyed a lot of power within this new emerging country. So I think that they were, whether they truly believed it was unconstitutional or not is debatable.
So in going back to the original canal, functionally, economically, financially, how did it work? Did it prove to be a very valuable asset?
It did. So it was so successful. So they built it in sections, and each section opened, the potential grew, and more people could see the value in it. And by the time it opened in 1825, the complete row, the complete line, business was already bustling, and it quickly paid for itself in tolls within the first 10 years. And, you know, there are numbers of 60% of New York State's overall budget came from the canal. There was no income tax at the time, so a lot of the state government was funded on revenue from the canal system. It certainly was a economic boom for those along the route and provided an avenue for immigrants and settlers, both foreign and Americans, to head out west and settle, knowing that you could now have an outlet to the market and get things that you're used to. And that's one thing that a lot of people overlooked. There were products going out as well, and I've read, you know, diaries where people were hesitant to go west because they didn't want to lose their connection to what they were used to. They didn't want to rough it, as we would say. So luxuries that you're used to in New York, all of a sudden, once the canal's open, you can get that kind of stuff all along the route and into the Great Lakes. High-end furniture or, you know, seafood, things like that, could now travel quicker, and you could have the things that you're used to.
So the economic development impact, as you describe it, really paid off. Was this a model for other canal development in the eastern part of the United States?
Yes. I mean, they call it the canal boom or canal fever, and it really set a precedent. And part of that is showing, because it was debated whether it was even constitutional for a state government to take on this kind of project. There were people that said, no, this should only be business. You know, the government isn't here for that kind of thing. And it set a precedent for not only how do you fund it, but also that you maintain it, which was new as well. For a state-level government to do that kind of thing, this was all precedent-setting. And again, new emerging company or country, and they were very proud of what was possible, and it showed what was possible. And again, it's big government, so there were debates. But other states followed suit, as well as some companies. There were a few successful private canals, private as in businesses, but other states along the eastern seaboard started building canals as well. Pennsylvania tried, and the challenge for, you know, a few of them were successful, nothing on the level of the Erie, but by the time they got going, you know, railroads were also picking up steam, literally.
And that was really what brought an end to the canal building era, was it not?
Yes.
So I think that it's a fascinating story because it tells us something about how a transportation technology that changes the cost structure for travel and for shipment really makes a difference, brings places closer together. It has an economic development impact. And the next technology that comes along seems to have the capability to dominate the last technology. If we go to the canal today, what can we see? How can we experience it?
Well, the the Erie Barge Canal and there were other canals as well on the system, the Champlain Canal being one of them, which was also built at the same time as the Erie. It was all part of the same legislation. But what you see today is a fully functional operating canal. The commercial traffic is much lower. It is really now for heritage tourism, quality of life. At one point, so the barge canal traffic really peaked in the 1950s and then declined. And, you know, for a while, communities along the canal turned their backs to it. Oh, that's just dirty water. But in the 1980s, they started to look back to the canal, and the state started investing in the canal as a tourist destination, and again, for quality of life for local residents. And you start to see visitor centers and parks and events. And now, today, the canal is very much alive. Festivals all along the canal, boaters doing the Grand Loop. There's a lot going on, and I think it's a reinvention that they never could have predicted, you know, 200 years ago, obviously. But it's a great reinvention, and it proves that it's still valuable. It brings lots of money into the communities. Also, they use it for hydroelectric power and for agriculture, for irrigation. So there are a lot of commercial values. Also, drinking water. Some communities use it for drinking water.
So it's a historical artifact, but it's an amazing model of what could be done, what can be done, and the impacts of an infrastructure investment. Is there an exhibit at your museum that we should go see to learn more about the canal?
We don't have. We had an exhibit, and it was a temporary exhibit for celebrating the beginning of construction, the 200th anniversary of the beginning of construction of the canal. But that exhibit has been turned into the book that we put together that you mentioned, Enterprising Waters, the History and Art of New York's Erie Canal. It includes two exhibits that we did, one on the history and one was art-based. The art-based exhibit was a shorter run. So we've combined that into the book. So right now we don't have an exhibit specifically on the Erie Canal, but the book is a great legacy of the exhibits that we were able to do.
So, Brad, I think what you're telling us is we ought to put that book on our reading list. I will certainly do that. And I also am putting on my list a place I need to visit is various locations along the Erie Canal. Thank you for spending the time to tell us about this amazing enterprise, and I look forward to seeing it in person. So thanks so much.
You're welcome. It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Infrastructure Show. If you enjoyed the conversation as much as we did, please subscribe to our podcast and encourage your friends to join us too. The Infrastructure Show is recorded at the Studio Media Recording Company in Evanston, Illinois, under the direction of Scott Steinman, recording engineer with a commitment to great sound. Our producer is Marion Sowers, a journalist with a passion for infrastructure. And I am Professor Joseph Schoeffer. Few people are more curious about infrastructure than I am.